Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. I am your host, Chase Dalton. This is part six of the Penobscot Expedition series. We are picking up the story on the eve of total defeat. An absolute disaster is about to befall a trapped American force. It is August 14th, 1779, and the Americans have previously been besieging a British fort in Penobscot Bay, that's in modern Maine. The Royal Navy has just arrived at the mouth of the bay, so the Americans are now effectively trapped by the British, who have just sailed their seven large warships into the bay. These warships have more than enough firepower to destroy the American fleet, which consists of 13 much smaller warships and 27 transport ships. It is just after midnight when Commodore Saltonstall, he's the guy who leads the American naval force, received the word that the British had entered the bay. Commodore Saltonstall told General Lovell the bad news, and Commodore Saltonstall recommended that the siege of the British fort be immediately lifted, that the 1,100-ish men ashore be loaded onto the transport ships, and that the transport ships immediately sail up the Penobscot Bay to the Penobscot River and away from the British warships. And so just a couple of minutes after midnight, General Lovell gave the order, and by 0100, regimental commanders were waking up their troops. Word of the retreat swept through the American camp, and then, as silently as possible, wrapped in the darkness and heavy fog, the soldiers ashore eagerly crept back to the boats. By the time dawn broke, all of the men had been loaded onto the transport ships. As the morning fog began to lift, the transport slipped away from the shore and headed towards the back of the Penobscot Bay, where the Penobscot River led deeper into the Maine wilderness. An hour later, when General McLean, and he's the guy who led the British land force, woke up, the rebel lines surrounding his fort seemed just a little too quiet. He ordered a patrol, which quickly discovered that the rebels were no longer there. General McLean then sent out heavily armed patrols to try and intercept the rebels in their retreat, but it was too late. Among the naval captains, which made up Commodore Saltonstall's war council, there were two different strategies discussed to deal with the British fleet. There was no question of fighting them toe-to-toe. But some of the captains believed that the naval force should retreat up the river to find an advantageous position from which they could make a last stand, ideally somewhere where the superior power of the British fleet would be minimized. Another group advocated for gambling that the expedition ships could sneak past the British fleet and then out into the open ocean, where they would all then disperse and individually make their way back to Boston. In the end, after a lot of debate, the War Council unanimously decided to sail up the Penobscot River and find a way to make a last stand, and then, barring that, at least to burn the ships and supplies to prevent them from falling into British hands. And so throughout this retreat, the American battery on Banks Island, which had been captured in the first days of the siege, really was a crucial piece because it maintained a steady fire on the three British ships that had previously held such an awesome defensive position under the guns of the British fort. And this ended up being really vital to preventing these three British warships that were already in Penobscot Bay from sallying forth and disrupting the retreat of all those very vulnerable transport ships and the rest of the warships that were retreating up the Penobscot Bay to the Penobscot River, which is sort of at the back of the bay. The whole day of the retreat, Commodore Saltonstall and his British counterpart used all of their sailing skill to play for time and to play for distance, using the tides, the winds, and in the cases of many American ships, oars, to race for the mouth of the Penobscot River. Saltonstall knew that he needed to gain time to offload his men and to burn his ships before they could be captured in order to deny these very valuable supplies and these ships to the British. So throughout this retreat, the focus was really on retreat, not fighting, and only one American vessel so much as fired a single cannon shot at the pursuing British. This ship, the Hampton, she found herself cornered by three British frigates and made a doomed stand. Her captain wrote of the battle, quote, "My ship sailing heavy, the enemy soon came up with me, three frigates, and fired upon, one after another, and cut away my rigging and stays, etc., and hold me sundry times, and wounded some of my men. I found it impossible to join our fleet again, and was obliged to strike, although contrary to my will." End quote. And let me tell you that this particular captain could use some spelling lessons, even by the standards of the non-standardized spelling of the 18th century. He is a horrible speller, and basically every other word is underlined with that little red underline on my script. And so the race for the Penobscot River, it lasted all afternoon against weak winds, and at 6 p.m., the first of the transports entered the narrows that led to the river. With the British warships almost upon them, they grounded themselves. They disgorged their soldiers and their small sailing crews and lit the transport ships on fire behind them to prevent the boats from falling into British hands, obviously. This had the side effect of allowing the American warships to slip upriver, with the British warships reluctant to follow, when that meant pulling close to burning ships, which were throwing up these huge columns of sparks and smoke, plus the occasional secondary explosion as gunpowder stores were exploding on board. Because, after all, the Royal Navy had no intention of burning their ships. That was the American plan. So, with dark falling and the British temporarily left behind, Commodore Saltonstall had one last hope. He didn't think he'd be able to hold the Royal Navy off, but he might, just maybe, be able to find a defensible position upriver, anchor sort of like the British had before their reinforcements had arrived, and then wait out the British and maybe deal some damage before eventually the longer-range guns of the Royal Navy wore his force down. And so with a few Penobscot Indian allies, General Wadsworth joined a little canoe expedition upriver to search for a good but defensive position. Meanwhile, on shore, the army officers tried to assemble the army into a fighting unit. Yeah, they made the attempt to marshal the men and the supplies that hadn't gone up in smoke, but the militiamen, who had already started deserting even before the British reinforcements had arrived, because again, a lot of them didn't want to be there in the first place, they had taken this chance to basically melt away into the woods. And so the Penobscot Expedition's ground force largely ceased to exist at this point. At midnight, a brig was sunk in the narrows, leading to the Penobscot River in an attempt to create a little hazard of navigation for the British, but the captains knew that it wasn't going to be enough. This wasn't a long-term plan. The campaign was officially a disaster, despite, you know, what turned out to be a pretty darn successful retreat by the Americans. And so the next morning, General Lovell, he came up to see Commodore Saltonstall. They hadn't found a spot that was defensible by ship, but General Lovell had a pretty desperate plan. Lovell wanted to take the guns and ammunition from the warships, plus the few supplies scavenged from the burnt troop transports. And then, using primarily Commodore Saltonstall's sailors who hadn't fled into the woods, create a land fort a few miles upriver. And this fort would, you know, at least in theory, be able to hold off against the superior British, sort of like British General McLean had done and held out against him. But this was a fundamentally flawed plan. General McLean was playing for time because he knew that the Royal Navy would be able to lift his siege, be able to bail him out, if he was able to hold out long enough. But this was an impossible hope for the Americans. General Lovell was proposing to build a fort, while under British fire, undermanned, low on supplies, low on ammunition, low on gunpowder, against a superior force with zero hope of reinforcement. There was zero chance that the Continental Navy was going to arrive on the scene and relieve the siege. They didn't have the force to relieve it, even if the entire Continental Navy had been concentrated on Penobscot Bay. And the French were nowhere in the theater. It was a stupid plan, and in a very polite, old-fashioned way, Commodore Saltonstall basically told General Lovell that it was a stupid plan. Saltonstall told General Lovell that his plan was to burn the boats and allow the men to travel back to Massachusetts through the backwoods of New England, rather than be starved out and forced to surrender to the British. There are some pretty funny accounts of various generals also at this meeting giving seamanship and naval battle plans to Commodore Saltonstall. You know, oh, what if you did this? Why didn't you do this? What if we did this plan? You know, and Commodore Saltonstall and his ship captain seem to pretty easily explain again and again and again the very elementary flaws in each of these landlubbers' plans. And my takeaway from these accounts is that the army elements knew that they had messed up badly, but they were basically willing to try anything, whereas Commodore Saltonstall knew how badly the Massachusetts force was beaten and was determined to minimize any more pointless casualties. And so in the end, since Commodore Saltonstall was the leader of the naval element, he was not required to actually listen to the suggestions of the land element, so basically he didn't. Saltonstall began preparations to burn the ships, but he didn't do so yet. He drew them into the best defensive position close to shore that he could, and with the ships ready to burn on a moment's notice, also loaded all the cannons and was prepared to fire on the British as they approached. Until the last minute, he would try to inflict some damage, but he also kept his ships, again, close to shore to allow his sailors to escape, because again, no need to waste lives. However, we're here running into some of these same problems of there being a lot of unwillingly drafted participants in this expedition. In particular, right now I'm talking about the privateers. And the captains of these privateering boats made up the majority of the fighting force, and they correctly pointed out that they had come under a force contract that was only supposed to be an 18-day contract, but those 18 days were now long past. And they certainly had no interest in fighting for fighting's sake. Even with the plan to get out alive, some of them, and their crews too, would most likely die or be captured. And so in their opinion, it was much better to just burn the ships and get out well ahead of the British. The captains were ultimately overruled by Saltonstall, and some of the rebellious members of the privateer's crew who weren't too happy about that decision were slapped in irons and held below decks when they showed themselves to be a little bit less enthusiastic about their commodore's plans. And so the next day, the British had not approached for the final kill. They were still working out their plan. But before dawn on August 16th, a mysterious series of fires started on the privateering vessels. This was very convenient for the privateering captains, I must say. Nonetheless, this was very dangerous for the non-privateering warships as well. There's only a couple of them, but that's because they were wood and cloth and tar ships, all burnable stuff. And all the cannons were fully loaded in preparation for a fight, and that meant that if the barrels got too hot, they would either just fire or they might explode. And the crews aboard the naval vessels, they tried frantically to put out the fires, but it was no use. And with most of the vessels that were part of this planned defense burnt to the waterline, the remaining captains had a decision to make, and they just decided to burn their ships as well. The crews were evacuated, and new towering columns of flames leapt into the sky. At this point, the British, had a pretty good idea of what was going on, obviously. This represented the final blow for General Lovell. He had sailed to Penobscot Bay with an overwhelming force. Truly, they outnumbered the British in every way, and he had whiffed. He had then been bailed out by a brilliant retreat against overwhelming odds. It truly was a very good retreat in a moment of a lot of danger for the American force. But then his militia had melted away into the woods, and so they couldn't make an independent last stand against the British. And so he then pinned his hopes on an expensive last stand by the Navy to salvage a shred of honor. That had literally just gone up in smoke. And so he knew that he was obviously going to face some pretty hard questions back at home. But yet he had one last hope. It was a shred of an idea. He thought he would travel upriver to the Penobscot Indian villages and try and make a treaty with them against the British. So why he thought this would work after the Indians had just very clearly watched the Americans get thrashed by the British, I have no idea, but hey, it's an idea, I guess. So this is where I'm going to leave this episode. The retreat was a success despite the lack of planning and every other thing working against it. Men and supplies were lost. It devolved into a complete rout once the men's feet touched the shore. But very few lives are lost in a situation that could have gone much more badly for the Americans. All things considered, the retreat was a moderate success. And in the next part, I'm going to wrap up the Penobscot Expedition story with the story of the hundreds of men who eventually found their way back home in some combination of tragic, funny, and circuitous ways, and then the consequences back home. And I previewed this before, but this much money being lost and this big of a military failure meant that somebody has to take the blame. The state of Massachusetts was almost bankrupted after paying out all the privateering captains for their ships and their supplies, and so a circular game of finger-pointing and letter-writing began almost immediately. The game of finger-pointing and letter-writing began even before the British arrived, as everyone in charge saw that there was a pretty good chance that things were going to go south. But that'll get to wait for next week and part 7 of the series, which has gotten longer and longer. I hope you've enjoyed it thus far. This is the U.S. Naval History Podcast. You can leave me a rating. You can write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can tell your friends about it. You can sign up for the newsletter at usnavalhistory.com. You can even subscribe for as little as $3 a month or as really much as you want. I do want to thank the two people that have subscribed thus far. It means a lot to me, and I hope that you guys in particular are really enjoying this series. But even if you are not a subscriber, you can always send me an email at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. The link is also in the show description. And until next time, fair winds and following seas.